You're listening to Blind Entrepreneurship, an interview series podcast that highlights the stories of the top business professionals around the world. In each episode, we explore how entrepreneurs overcame blindness in business in order to execute their vision. This podcast is brought to you by Pendy. I am your host, Jonathan Kuzbowski, and today we have Jim Shulman on the show. Jim loves working with successful independent practitioners who are frustrated with the direction of their professional practice and their life. His clients tend to be devoted to their families and friends, driven to succeed, and passionate about helping others. He specializes, his specialties are practice management and development for financial advisors, attorneys, and CPAs based on their 30 years experience in sales and marketing. This is the crucial link between best practices and empathy with your role, often very lonely, as a business owner and manager. I've known Jim for several years now. I met him at a random networking event, and I can honestly say that he's one of those individuals where the minute you meet him, he has this aura surrounding him. He's incredibly sweet, nice, genuine, which is incredibly rare nowadays, and wants to see you succeed. He has an incredible memory as well. It makes you feel welcome at all times. I recall several times where he remembers the most obscure things, and brought up in conversation when I see him at another networking event or whatever it may be, whatever social event that it may be. And I always applaud and I always respect that. Jim's also a man of many stories. And I can recall every time I talk to him about how things are going or what's going on, I briefly mention what it is. And he goes into a brief story about something that he's experienced. And I think he's a man that has experienced a lot. And you'll be able to notice that in this episode. And in this episode, we talk about ego, stubbornness, and the definition of entrepreneurship. And I think he defines entrepreneurship in a way that will be incredibly relatable to a lot of people. To selfishly say, he defined just about every feeling that I've ever thought, and any inclination that I've ever had when it comes to my personal self, my mind, how I operate. And it was interesting to be able to hear that and then be able to say, wow, you know, that sounds a lot like me. And I'm sure it will sound a lot like you too if you are listening to this episode. It was great talking to you, old friend, and happy to finally have you on the show. Enjoy today's episode with Jim Shulman of Elsinore Business Associates. Today's episode is sponsored by Pendy. Are you in charge of marketing for your business and need graphic design support? Let Pendy design anything you need for your business, from a logo to your marketing materials, sales sheets, social media content, and so much more. Pendy helps you achieve more with unlimited graphic design support, daily output, and a dedicated project manager, all at one flat monthly rate. We have an exclusive offer to the blind entrepreneur community. Head over to pendy.co and use the coupon code BLIND for 15% off your first month. Again, that's pendy.co. PENJI.co and use the coupon code BLIND for 15% off your first month of Pendy. And now, let's get to today's episode. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. Appreciate it, Jonathan.
Oh, absolutely. We've known each other for a pretty decent time now, so it's pretty exciting to have you on, finally have you on the show.
Well, it's a great thing being here. Thank you.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So I cut you off mid-sentence because I feel like, why not? Because you're talking about some really cool stuff. And just to kind of re-educate the people that are listening, you're talking about the surge of, or at least the potential downfall of Subaru. So before we get into like who you are and what you do and all that other fun stuff, just finish your thought. Tell us a little bit more about what you're talking about, because I thought it was really good stuff.
Well, just for the audience's sake, I'm not talking about currently the possible downfall of Subaru. This goes back almost 30 years. And it's a great example of a company mistake when they listen to the wrong thing from customers. In the late in the late 1980s, Subaru was developing a real cult following of active people who wanted a tough four-wheel drive car that was relatively inexpensive, easy to maneuver, and so forth. And they started to get some complaints that their cars were starting to get too expensive. So to address those complaints, they made one of the biggest bombs in their production career, which was called the Justy. And for those of us who are under the age of 40, a Justy was a three-cylinder Subaru that had an option of two-wheel drive or four-wheel drive. And to call it underwhelming is probably the nicest thing you could have said about it. It was a bomb in the marketplace and almost wrecked Subaru's reputation. So if you ever see Subaru and they describe that all of their cars are always constant four-wheel drive, it's because of cars like the Justy. Mm-hmm. And if you're considering what your brand is, the first thing you have to look at is, am I compromising the integrity of what I built? Fortunately, Subaru was able to surmount that PR disaster, or certainly the disaster with a product that was not appropriate to what they were about. And that's why we see tons of Subarus today, and they definitely are not Justies.
Well, and that's a great story, and thank you so much for sharing that. To kind of backtrack, to give people a little bit more about who you are, I'd like to just give a quick story about what got you here and why are you a qualified expert to talk about the life, the world, the beauty, the downfalls of business?
Well, let me see. I'm going to be 60 in 3 weeks, so I've seen quite a bit. I've seen 3-4 stock market collapses in my lifetime. I've seen trends come and go. I've been involved in sales and marketing since the early 1980s with a huge variety of products. And if I were to sum up what I've seen is that people are still basically people, mm-hmm. but the technology that is involved in our lives has infinitely changed communication and personal relationships. And it's had effects that nobody could ever have foreseen. Maybe if you were a science fiction writer, you might have had a taste of it. But it also requires being constantly curious about what's new and what's different. So that's why I'm sitting here. And one of my passions is speaking and working with people who are under age 35. Because yeah. That is not only the future, that's the present. And it's very different from the ways that I would interact with people of my age cohort.
Yeah, and to that point, I think it has a lot to do with like mindset. And there's a lot of things that are on your website, phrases that are really strong and powerful when it comes to, you know, from their life, from their business, from their dreams. And it doesn't always start that way, but it usually hits to that point in the later parts of their life or the later parts of their careers. So I'd like to talk a little bit about mindset and how to get there when it comes to entrepreneurship. Can you tell me the importance of mindset and some of the things that you've seen throughout the course of your business career? And how can we improve our mindsets in order to live a life of lavishness or luxury, et cetera? Or even business, or even business success.
Well, I'm going to step back and parse out a few things. You began by talking about entrepreneurship. And in my experience, Jonathan, there are two types of people. There are people who were born to be entrepreneurs, and there are people who were not born to be entrepreneurs. And there are certain characteristics of people who are great entrepreneurs, and I'll get to that in a minute. One of the things that kind of... I'll just say disappoints me is the focus in recent years on pushing entrepreneurship. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're having huge changes in the workforce where it's not as easy as it was when I was beginning my career to go out and get a W-2 job. In those days, there were these things called entry-level positions that paid enough of a salary so that you could, you know, get a crummy car and live in an apartment with not too many cockroaches. But your company stood by you, they paid you, you would stick with the company, and you could build a career. Well, those jobs are gone. They're called internships now, and they pay nothing or next to nothing, and maybe you'll get a job, and maybe the business will be here next year. The statistic I saw is that by the time somebody is 40 years old today, they've had 11 different jobs, which was unheard of two generations ago. But getting back to entrepreneurs, what I've seen, I think the focus on that is fear. That unless you're an entrepreneur, you're not going to be able to have a life where you can support yourself, where you're going to have some level of control over your destiny. And I think that that's a misnomer, particularly when I've seen schools that offer entrepreneurship majors. It's a little bit like saying, I'm going to offer a major for having brown eyes. Maybe get contact lenses, but you really don't have brown eyes. What I've seen with entrepreneurs over the years is that almost all of them have had some trauma in adolescence or early adulthood. When trauma meaning, you know, dad lost all their money, mom was permanently disabled, sibling committed suicide, there was a squid in the whale quality, horrible divorce. And when your adult personality is being formed and you have that kind of huge upheaval, typically you go in one of two directions. It's a little bit like Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind after the Civil War, when she said, as God is my witness, I'll never go hungry again. She was the right age cohort, age at that point for making the shift into entrepreneurship. And in her case, it was, I will do whatever is humanly necessary to claw myself out of this situation. That's one approach that people have. Some people just give up after that kind of horrific experience. And it's very common for clients of mine to have a sibling who's 43 years old and doing 420 behind a dress barn where they've been assistant manager for 10 years. Very often entrepreneurs, actually almost all the time, are ADD, ADHD, which is far more common. They are constantly being bounced from one idea or one shiny thing to another. They typically relate really, really well to clients and getting stuff done, meaning forming a relationship, starting an opportunity, being able to make something happen. That's not a great personality for being a manager. And most of the entrepreneurs I work with have a key employee who can translate what I'll call entrepreneur crazy into a level of stability that a staff can use to be functional. And there's also, with most entrepreneurs, major issues about control. Remember, the entrepreneur survived by taking control in their life. And yet they have to give up some measure of control if their organization is going to grow. And that can be very, very painful. Entrepreneurs tend to be unbelievably doting spouses and parents, where they want to make sure that their kids never, ever have to go through the kind of trauma that they went through. Very often, unfortunately, that results in spoiled kids or kids that lack the kind of drive that their parents had. And sometimes there's friction when those kids reach early adulthood and the entrepreneur is frustrated that their kid isn't functioning the way they did. Sometimes entrepreneurs will put up with the most awful marriages imaginable just for the sake of keeping stability, and that can be very dysfunctional. They tend to be very generous people. They're the first ones to raise their hand to volunteer or to write a check, and they tend to be disappointed when the organization or the person they went out of their way to help doesn't reciprocate or really doesn't know how to reciprocate. It's a strange, strange set of circumstances that makes an entrepreneur and how an entrepreneur behaves. And it definitely is not for everyone.
Well, and that's an absolutely beautiful answer. And I'm sure there's people that are listening right now that are probably going in their head, check, 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 check. I know for me, there's a lot of things that you said that check off when it comes to what you just explained about entrepreneurship. I guess my first thought is that more so like, and this is transparency here, is that just more so a self-reflection of who you are, or is that more so the people that you've seen and the people that you've worked with? And then maybe you can give us like, you know, some case studies of people that you've worked with and how are you able to, well, actually I won't get into the how afterwards, but like, let's just talk about like, where did you base, how are you basing this definition from, or where are you basing this definition from?
Experience.
Yeah.
35 years of experience. And what I found is that I had been a W-2 employee for years, but I only worked with small companies that were, if not startups, then certainly into maybe the second stage, where the owners were wild men and women. And the best way I could describe it or that experience was it was like riding a mechanical bull. It isn't animus with most of the entrepreneurs I've worked with. I'm lucky when I was a W-2 in that they were not evil people, but certainly it required that level of flexibility. And what I found when I started my practice in 1996 is I began by offering marketing services. And I recognized that the marketing services, most of the people were buying turned out to be wallpaper, where they had underlying problems. In other words, I need a new website because my sales are bad. Well, your sales are bad because your salesman is not only incompetent, but a thief. And that was the case in one company. There were other places where they thought they needed, marketing materials. And basically the marketing materials were a CYA for people in senior management in the organization who didn't sell, who couldn't sell. So they were designing materials for people who had to sell. Mm-hmm. And you could imagine that's kind of like a recipe for dysfunction. Yeah. And what got me started focusing just on advising entrepreneurs was in Christmas week of 1999, I was in the hallway of a major insurance company. And I don't know if you or your listeners had ever seen the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Of course.
In that film, there's a scene where they're pushing a cart through a village during one of the medieval plagues, and somebody's yelling, "Bring out your dead, bring," and people are throwing bodies on the cart. Well, an admin walked down the hallway yelling, "Bring out your marketing materials," and people were coming out of their offices flinging shrink-wrapped piles of marketing materials into a dumpster. And I looked at that and I realized, I am never going to make dumpster food again. I only want to work with the poor person who's trying to run their own enterprise and their own life and has to deal with literally garbage like that. So starting in 2000, I exclusively began working with entrepreneurs, and they've covered many different fields, from wealth management to a place that restored vintage cars to one place that sold natural herbal-based personal lubricants to fundamentalist Christian women.
Interesting.
I didn't look for that one. It found me.
I can imagine. I guess the next thought is, how do you control it? Because
what do you mean control?
Well, when I mean control, I mean the mindset. Because the first thing that comes to my mind, again, was the words ADHD and the constant like stimulation of seeing what's there and not being able to focus and needing that employee, so to speak. And we can get into that very briefly. But how do you advise business owners, entrepreneurs, to control that mindset, to control whatever it is that that person's going through, to control the ADHD that they potentially could have, more often than not self-diagnosed?
I would describe it as question and steering rather than control. Mm. One of the things I found is that when I work with somebody, I admit at the beginning of the relationship, I cannot change you and I do not want to change you. What I can do is offer options and discuss objectively not only what the options are, but what some of the repercussions of decisions might be, including a decision not to make a decision. So in the event of frustration about communications within an office, it might be a discussion of two things. Do you want to change this? And I can help you deal with some of these frustrations you may have. I can be a sounding board, a venting person. Very often, I am the person between the key employee who wants to do more, who is really competent, who sometimes is begging to do more, and the entrepreneur who just doesn't know how to give up that level of autonomy. And a lot of it's courage. A lot of it is figuring out maybe it is time for me to make some level of change. That said, an entrepreneur will constantly bounce back between wanting control and wanting to give up parts of control and new ideas. So that's a little bit more what it is. It's more steering than control. And a constant revisiting of what is stimulating you today. Why is this more important than other things we're doing? If there's something you absolutely cannot stand doing, let's either eliminate it or offload it. And there are some things that only you as the entrepreneur can do. And how can we make those as simple as possible so that they'll get done? And a lot, large part of it too is buy-in. You know, are you okay with making change? Sometimes I have what I'll call my come to Moses conversation with a person saying, we agreed to do certain things. You haven't been doing them. You've been avoiding them. You know, it's probably not a good use of our time to continue unless you're going to make that change. Sometimes mm-hmm. I'll get in somebody's face. And with many entrepreneurs, very few people want to get in their face because most people surrounding an entrepreneur have some kind of vested interest. They might be the main source of income for a family. The employees, for instance, depend upon the entrepreneur and don't want to sacrifice or, you know, or jeopardize their jobs. Vendors certainly might not want to do it. There might be one or two outside advisors, but the outside advisors usually don't understand what's going on with the entrepreneur's personal life. And there is no separation between personal and business with an entrepreneur. You know, people talk about we have to have the separation. That's garbage. In 35 years, I've never seen a true separation. They bleed into one another. You live what you do.
Yeah. And that is very true as well. How much of it do you think is ego and how much of it do you think is stubbornness? Or are they one and the same?
I'll put in fear and aversion. We'll go back to Thomas Hobbes. You know, that's over 2.5 centuries ago. Entrepreneurs come to what they're doing from fears and aversions. They're fearful of ever being put in the vulnerable position they were when they were younger. And they have an aversion to, lack of control. They get excited by things that are going to make them feel better. But fundamentally, they're never going to be content. So the real question is, or I'll put it this way, entrepreneurship is a chronic condition that cannot be cured and must constantly be treated. And sometimes the treatments go in and out. You might deal with certain levels of things going on in an entrepreneur's life. It's very common for me to have a client that I might work with for 3 or 4 years. We stop working together, and then 5 years later, I get a call from them that another set of situations came up or parts of their personality manifested themselves where they weren't as functional as they wanted to be, and we came back. And a lot of it is saying, you know, A, I know who you are, or we can figure that out, and B, I'm not going to judge you. You are who you are, and we're not changing one bit of that.
What are some steps that we can take in order to, I guess, just like, you know, let's just call a spade. There are a lot of people that are listening right now that may not be able to afford a consulting service, or they may not be able to afford a coach, or what would you actually, let me start there. What would you properly define yourself?
I'm somewhere between a coach, a business advisor, and an unlicensed psychiatrist.
Yeah. So to that, again, there's people that aren't going to be able to afford that, and they don't have the resources or the understanding to be able to find an individual like yourself. And so my question is, what do you say?
I'll jump in. In order for somebody to work with me, it requires a certain level of experience. In other words, when you realize the value of having somebody who works with successful entrepreneurs, you have to be at a level of success where you can deal with that. Do you have several employees? Is that a matter of being able to have enough stuff going on in your life that comes with success? Yeah. Do I have issues of balancing competing opportunities? Do I have issues of finance and expansion? Those are things that usually are issues that come of success. Somebody who's starting out as an entrepreneur, basically they have their one major issue was kill if I must, but I am going to be successful.
Yeah.
And that's not something necessarily that you use coaching with. I have worked with a couple of very young entrepreneurs who, when we started working together, were successful and were out of the gate and were doing things like rapidly adding employees, rapidly changing things. In other words, they had characteristics that many seasoned entrepreneurs share. They were more anomalies. And in those cases, if it was significant enough and if I had enough control, the compensation might have been partially part of the company as well as a nominal amount of money.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's not going to be that way. It's going to be somebody who is already successful. And frankly, those are the people who, A, can stroke a check because you and I like eating occasionally and putting gasoline in a car. But more to the point, it's going to be far more interesting because with success comes more challenging issues to deal with.
So, and listen, you and I both love food. We talk about it probably every time we see each other in some degree of fashion, in addition to history. But when it comes to
metabolism, where you can, by the way, Jonathan.
Yeah. I fully plan on doing that. I need to use it to the most of my advantages as best as I can. But I'd like to hear about steps and some small things that we could probably take away from this conversation to apply into our lives today. And in order to fix a lot of the weird craziness and lifestyle of entrepreneurship, it starts with small things that you could do today in order to for it to become much bigger tomorrow. So if you could kind of give us like a blueprint and how-to guide in order to mediate this, what are some things that you would recommend that we take in order to just start this life of, I guess, clarity?
All right. Are we assuming that we're talking about people who have those characteristics of entrepreneurs? Or are we?
Yeah, because the people that are listening are probably everything that you just said. And I'll even say that, yeah, it's including myself. So I like to, like, that's what I would like to know is like the blueprint. What can we do today that can help us tomorrow?
All right.
So definitely good assumption.
Good. I'm going to start with something that I have found invaluable is let's start with some of the characteristics of millennial generation people, which frankly have floored me. In spite of the fact that boomers are now have a cliche of hating everything about millennials, I wish some of the values of your generation were around when I was your age. And I'll give you an example. No bullshit. When you're talking with somebody in your age cohort, Jonathan, it is get to the point. Don't give me a lot of flowery whatever. Don't lie to me because I'm going to detect it in about 2 or 3 seconds. Number two is reaching out to many, many different people. And I'll call it decentralization of information. Back when I was beginning my career, the idea of a successful person was somebody who had the keys to the kingdom. They were all knowing, they were all wise, people deferred to them, and that's how they retained power. What I'm seeing in your age cohort is that that's not an issue at all. You're willing to share information and learn things from people in France, New Zealand. We could have a conversation with 6 specialists all over the map. So you don't see those types of demarcations. The other thing is the willingness to fail frequently and often. When I saw that the statistic, and I think it's even higher, that somebody by age 40 has over 11 jobs, that's really fantastic. You know, you're not going into life with the idea that you're going to sit somewhere and marinate, that there are going to be many opportunities and things might be successful, they might blow up, they're going to recombine. But tomorrow morning not only can be, but probably will be completely different. And that you need to have resilience within your makeup to be able to handle that. The other thing is empathy. There seems to be, at least from my perception, far more interest in how the people surrounding you get along and feel than there was when I began my career. In other words, it does, when I began my career, the ethos was more or less, we don't care how you feel. This is what the company's policy is and just effing do it. Mm-hmm. And today, unless you get that kind of, I'm just going to say not only respect, but shared mission, people not only are not going to listen, they'll just walk away. And these are all issues that entrepreneurs need to consider if they're going to be successful and they're going to build an enterprise.
You mentioned the word empathy, something that is a word that is thrown around often. And I can confidently say that it is something that, in my opinion, I think it's more of a trained to feel the world, to have a feeling of empathy. I do believe that it is a trained art and not necessarily something that most people are born with, very similar to entrepreneurship. That's my opinion. You can disagree, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
My thoughts, and there are many, many different definitions of empathy. There was one group of people I met with a while ago who were arguing over at least 3 or 4 different interpretations. Mine is a shared experience where you can share having some common ground with the other person. Empathy might be, we both took Professor X's class in college and Professor X was a tyrant and how we survived this and so forth. Empathy might be, we are both survivors of a terrible disease, or we were both people who went to this outrageously wonderful music festival in 2009 and have an experience with that that really can't readily be shared. There was an article that I published today about a fellow who became the leading financial advisor for professional basketball players. He had been an aspiring professional basketball player and almost made it, you know, came within a hair's breadth of making it, but his career was dashed and he wound up pivoting and through a lot of hard work, he wound up becoming a successful wealth manager. But he was empathic with the basketball players because he knew what that life was. Mm-hmm. And when they could sit and talk with him, it was not somebody who could say, oh yes, you're a person with X, Y, and Z needs. It's somebody else who knows what it's like to have certain experiences, certain fears, certain ambitions. And that's how I view empathy. I can see being sympathetic to somebody, which is being able to say, I can understand what you might be going through. And I'll give an example, hot button issue. I can be sympathetic to somebody who is a racial minority that I am not, as a cisgendered Caucasian late middle-aged man. I cannot be empathetic. I have not lived that life. I can understand what they might be going through, but viscerally, I can't do it because I'm not that situation. In that situation, I haven't lived that situation. What I think is extremely important is to admit those limitations to the other person. Yeah. Don't pretend that you're empathetic when you're not, because, and it goes back to a bullshit detector, people will sense that immediately and you'll lose credibility. Yeah. A lot of what I'm seeing that's very effective is when people admit their limitations and they don't pretend to be Superman. An example, I once belonged to a professional organization of consultants, largely consultants, and people would go to the meetings and most of the time was spent in posturing about how brilliant they were and how successful they were. And by the way, you really need to hire me tomorrow so I can bring my genius to your organization. Well, that was great for a bunch of people in a room with great hair. You can imagine how well that would go over if you were in a room with a bunch of 20-somethings.
Yeah, and I think something that's incredibly important is, you know, the idea behind ego, the idea behind, I guess, just stubbornness, and you've seen a lot of it, and I think it comes down to being self-aware. And I would say a lot more often than not, a lot of people aren't aware of the things that they're saying, and they're not aware of the things that they're doing.
You are 1,000% right. And if we were to boil down the various points that we've been talking about this morning, I would say self-awareness would be close to the top of the list.
Yeah.
Crucially important to success, and it is all too rare.
Do you think it could also be a downfall that you're sometimes that you're too self-aware, but there's no action?
Well, and we're going to go back to entrepreneurship, in that entrepreneurship inherently are people who take action. Sometimes an entrepreneur might be reluctant to take action for a variety of reasons. It might be an admission of failure. It might be an admission that they don't want certain types of confrontation. A characteristic I've seen repeatedly with entrepreneurs is a great hesitance to fire completely dysfunctional employees. They yeah. want to give people chances. They want to be able to let somebody help and, you know, become successful. And they're repeatedly frustrated. I worked with a client a number of years ago who had two employees who were making over six figures. And the employees very often didn't even show up, let alone couldn't perform their job competently. Mm-hmm. It took over 18 months of working with this entrepreneur. And I had the backing of the entrepreneur's spouse and other advisors. It was almost as if we were formed a Greek chorus saying, fire the SOBs, yeah. take the money and put it in a bank, you're better off. Yeah. And still it took a year and a half for that person to take action. That's not all that uncommon, surprisingly. Hmm.
So even though, I mean, I guess the silver lining here is, even though, as long as you're aware of the problem and you have the resources and hopefully the people around you to make you aware of these problems, it doesn't have to be fixed overnight. As long as you're working towards that goal and towards that mission, whatever it may be, that you're more likely to be able to achieve success, whatever it is defined by you.
Well, I'm going to break it up into a couple of components. The first thing is an admission of your strengths and your limitations. Everybody has them. and they vary from person to person. The second is the understanding that this is not going to be a linear improvement. It's more going to be a jagged line going back and forth, where people wind up coming together to help or guide the other person who may be going off on an unproductive tangent. And the, also related to that is knowing that there has to be some structure, ongoing structure. And the balance with an entrepreneur is entrepreneurs want some structure, they need structure, and they hate structure. So it's a constant, I'm going to say, push back and forth. I think the best analogy I would have to it for, I don't know if you know of anyone who's been through programs that end in anonymous, like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous.
No, and so I don't.
But there are typically 12 steps. And the first step is to admit that you are powerless over whatever the thing happens to be. The second is giving it up to something greater than yourself. And then the third steps beyond that point introduce levels of complete humility and honesty, as well as structure on behavior. And it's a balance between getting to complex issues, but behaving on very simple terms. And it is wonderful for people whose lives are out of control. Not surprisingly, in my experience, I've seen a lot of drug and alcohol abuse among successful entrepreneurs. And part of the wildness of their life are these types of behaviors to get away from very often what I see is like the searing pain of being an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs don't have the option of not being entrepreneurs. You know, it would be like telling a giraffe that they had to swim. You know, it's not going to happen, but it's not going to happen.
I would actually pay to see that happen.
Well, it wouldn't be a giraffe for very long.
Yeah, very true.
And that's the concern. And the question is going to be, how do you have behaviors to take away that searing pain or to manage it that are not going to be self-destructive or destructive to your enterprise or destructive to your family or, you know, partner?
Yeah.
That's where a really, really great challenge lies.
Yeah, that's great. I absolutely love everything that you speak about, what you believe in as a human being and your approach to life. I think it's so refreshing, and I couldn't be more happy that you're on the show today, that you're talking about life. It's not even more so about business. I mean, there are undertones to business, yes, but you're just more so just having a conversation and talking about your philosophies on life. Would you say that's relatively true?
Well, and I'm going to take a step further. Thanks to the way we live today, if you want to learn anything about business, there's a YouTube video. There's a blog. There is not only no shortage of information, but in most cases, you can reach out to a professional and get one-to-one advice as long as you are nice about it. And there's a whole process that I use or work with people about how to ask for advice and do it effectively. The point is, you can learn anything now, anywhere, about issues in business. It's not tough. And guess what? There is no unique situation in business. Okay. Yeah. Every situation has happened, you know, whether it's something literal like inventory questions or finance and so forth, or personnel. The real point beyond that is personal, and it's mindset and its approach to the world. And that's where entrepreneurs very often start asking existential questions. Why am I here? Why do I feel this way? Why do I keep repeating things? This is what I want. Well, I'll bring it back. One of the things I would ask everyone to consider is, when you say what you want, is it what you think you should want? Or is it what you are afraid to admit that you want? And they are very, very different things. And I have a business example of that. Many years ago, the IHOP chain, the pancake houses, were in serious trouble. And they brought in a new CEO. and the new CEO conducted market research, and everybody said that they needed healthy alternatives, and the food was bad, you know, and unhealthy at IHOP and so forth. We want salads, we want fresh vegetables. The CEO nodded and said, okay, I hear you. And the CEO introduced double stuffed French toast, and the sales went through the ceiling. And the reason was people thought that they had to say something versus what they really and truly wanted in their now artery-clogged hearts. They wanted the double-stuffed French toast. They didn't feel that they had the freedom to admit that to another person.
Yeah. Great, great stuff today, Jim. And again, I'm very thankful, and I'm very appreciative of your time. And there's one thing that I think people should know about you and I's relationship, and it's more so based off of just normal human conversations like these, but it also involves things outside of work, which is food, which we talk about, but also just I'm not big of a car person, but I know you are. So I'd like to just ask you some personal questions just for fun as we wrap up here. The two questions will be, what is your favorite car of all time? And I know that's going to be a hard question to ask. The second one would be, what are some places that you think we should try when it comes to food?
Okay.
Assuming that you're in the Philadelphia region.
All right. And I'm going to give you some general answers on that.
The specific
answer, though, my favorite car of all time would be a 1960 Chrysler 300C convertible.
Interesting.
Okay, Chrysler had a series of cars between 1955 and 1965, which were a weird amalgamation. They were super luxury two-door hardtops or convertibles that had unbelievably powerful engines. Whereas somebody once described them to me as a gorilla in a prom dress. And probably the most outrageous of them was in 1960. They had a huge metal tail fins in the back. And for those who are under 40, I recommend you go on Google and look up images and type in Chrysler tail fin. They were bizarre things that were very stylish for a while and took the auto industry by storm. So you have this outrageous, outrageous looking car. The dashbowl looks like a giant fishbowl with little inserts that glowed. You know, in other words, the speedometer didn't have lights. There was literally a panel that glowed. Mm-hmm. But yet it had a huge, big block engine, and for the time, fairly sophisticated fuel delivery. So as a result, this car could easily do 140 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And it's just the combination of the power and outrageousness that I loved. If I were to talk about food in a general way, I would say this. Find an ethnic enclave that is in Philadelphia. And the good news is there are no shortage of them. And if I had to draw a gastronomic map today of where I would go, it would be the Northeast and it would be in West Philadelphia. In other words, go into a Jamaican community or Jamaican mm-hmm. expatriate community in West Philadelphia. Go into the Brazilian community in Northeast Philadelphia, huge emerging Chinese community in Northeast Philadelphia, amazing restaurant I went to recently there, Russian restaurants in the far Northeast. As one example, something that I did a while ago is there is a regular cricket match that takes place on the huge lawn in front of the Please Touch Museum. Mm-hmm. And the players are Jamaican expatriates. And around the perimeter, everybody is barbecuing. And one day I walked around with a stack of singles and barbecued a barbecue and had the time of my life. You know, most people, you think a pile of singles meant you're going to a stripper joint. In my case, it's going to be barbecues.
That's beautiful. And I can totally see you doing that. That's funny. Well, I appreciate it again, Jim. It's an absolute honor. And if you could just give the last 30 seconds to tell everybody a little bit more about where they could find you, how they can get in contact with you, potentially hire you if they so choose.
All right. You can get in touch with me by internet, which is elsinoreba.com. That's ElsinoreBA.com. or you can go to LinkedIn, and it's Jim Shulman, spelled S-H-U-L-M-A-N, where you can read about maybe three or four dozen different articles. I publish an article that I've written about twice a week. And you can contact me through either of those two places, and I look forward to meeting you.
And you also have a pretty cool, I would say, Saturday-related email series?
Saturday-related email?
You have like a personal email series, don't you?
Yes, I do. Thank you for mentioning that. On request, and I have this as a footer in all of my business emails, every 2 weeks I publish an article, and the articles have nothing to do with business because, again, I think, you know, business articles for the most part are crap. You know, it's five passive aggressive reasons why you should hire me immediately, which are the same five passive aggressive reasons that other people have recently posted. What I talk about are things that I've seen in life, things that I've experienced, and there are immediate applications. One example, I just published an article which is going to be in one of my upcoming newsletters about people who are passionate about a sports-related career. In other words, that seems to be a fantasy somebody has in a vague way. I'm going to do something in sports, or I've developed a career, so I want to work with people in sports. And almost always it fails because, yeah, you and everybody else on the planet want to do it. But there is one fellow who did do it, a man named Joe McLean, and he works exclusively with professional basketball players. And there are characteristics of why he was successful that make perfect sense in a business way, but they also relate mainly to about who Joe McLean is and what his life experiences are, how he can be empathetic with the players, and also what his ethical values are. And those go well beyond business. Those are the sorts of things I write about.
And it's a great email newsletter indeed. So even though we all need less emails, I do think it's a good one to partake in.
My answer to that, by the way, Jonathan, is never write anything you wouldn't want to receive.
Very true. Very true. And I love your humor too. I think you have a really interesting humor that I think is palpable and fun. So. And I also love the underlying connotations to everything you say. I feel like everything is tongue in cheek, which is also always fun.
Well, I'm glad you like it.
All right, Jim, thanks for your time. Appreciate it. You've been listening to Blind Entrepreneurship, brought to you by Penji. Our guest this week was Jim Shulman. All of the links that Jim mentioned, including the car that he mentioned at the very end of the conversation, will be in the show notes for you to check out. After looking at the car, I'm not a big car person, but it is a pretty damn cool looking car, especially with the dashboard, as he mentioned. So make sure you check that out. All right, listeners, I'm sending a worldwide challenge this week. I'd like you to take a look at your to-do list and for the day or the following day and look at it deeply and think to yourself, is there anything on this list that if I don't do it today, my business will be just fine? Focus on the things that truly matter and the things that move boulders and not pebbles. You can check Penji out at penji.co if you need simple, easy, and affordable graphic design for your business. And head over to our podcast website, which is tbeshow.com, to drop a comment, let us know that you like it, check in, see how you're doing. We'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoyed this episode, it would mean the absolute world to us if you were to share this with a friend today. It's the only way that we can cure blindness in business. Go out there and execute your vision, everybody. Have a great rest of your day.